Hey, welcome back once again to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. More rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast in the world. That's my claim. We are breaking down the rhetoric out there, cleaning up the rhetorical world, something like that. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques. So why don't you learn some rhetoric? That's the idea. I'm Dr. Dan French, escaped professor, American rhetorician. I parachuted out of the ivory tower and into the real world and ended up in late night comedy, doing a lot of stuff in Hollywood for quite a while. And now I'm sort of circling all the way back around and I'm rescuing my rhetorical roots. This podcast, I have a few different purposes on this podcast. I talk to comedians about their politics to see how things, pinballs are bouncing around inside of those brains. I convert conservatives. So if you have a conservative and you want them talked out of it, send them to me. That's been an interesting project. And I bring on persuasion experts and steal their information for you so that you can learn some stuff from them. And like I said, more rhetoricians than anybody else. And that brings us to this week. Another rhetorician, one of my favorite rhetoricians of all time, directed both my thesis and my dissertation, Glutton for Punishment, managed to get them both through. Pretty amazing. University of Iowa, right?
I did.
Yep. Taught at UT Austin for a long time and then University of South Florida for ever and ever and ever, and is now, I think, emeritus?
Retired.
I don't know what the difference is. Pretty name for retired. But really fascinating guy, and I'm super excited about talking to him again today. So welcome, Dr. David Payne.
Well, thank you, and good to be here.
Yeah, and you were worried about your whole social media YouTube look, but I think, I mean, you nailed it. That's
I've not cultivated any, but...
Have you seen Room Raiders? Like you can find it on Twitter, but it goes in and rates everybody's podcast background. It's pretty good.
I see. Well, I wondered if you had dropped the Seascape behind Llewellyn, for instance. And
Nope, he did all that.
He did that. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't have those skills at all. So.
Yeah, but you know, like the they'll tell you things like in Room Raider, they'll actually give you advice, none of which I follow because I'm going really low tech podcast. I don't want to be judged on any aesthetic attempt. So I just completely escape, you know, the success factor and say it's the same background, same me every time. But like you have, you know, interesting architecture back there. You've got some wooden rollers over there. They got
this,
some.
This is the kitchen, right?
Yeah.
So Kitchen Table Talk is a good brand. And, but I'm so technically retro. I didn't know what filters were until the cat attorney meme popped up. So
nice. That was great, wasn't it? That
it was funny.
The aesthetics are just emerging, like on podcasts and Zooms, like even this, the fact that we're split screen, because I could do this where it just jumps back and forth according to whoever's talking, but I find that to be kind of disorienting.
Right.
But on Variety for the aesthetic, it's going to be the same thing pretty much the whole time. So, you know, but people are lowering their bar, which I find to be
a good thing. Different things. Different media will attend to different things.
So give people just a little of your background. I gave a quick overview. Just give people the relevant points of who is David Payne.
Wow, yes, the tough ones. I guess I got interested. I came from a traditional speech background and performance and drama. And I guess I thought I would be a teacher. When I was growing up, I thought I would be a lawyer. And then somehow the early 70s, it just didn't seem like the thing it was.
Yeah.
Back in the Perry Mason days. So I thought because I'd been influenced by teachers. And I don't know, I guess after graduation, I bounced around for a year or so and enrolled in a few graduate courses. And it took hold. So.
I seem to remember your working class background, right? Is your family fairly working class?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, my folks both work for Boeing Aircraft in Wichita.
Right. Right. And you did a little bit of factory work along the way at some point.
Well, I did actually work for Boeing for about 3 months after I graduated, which made my mom really happy and made me really miserable. And that didn't go too well. So.
Yeah, I remember a story you used to tell about that, about you realized, like, you used to have this line about work is prison measured in time, I think. And
I had a poster in my office door for a long time. It was, I think, from the Charlie Chaplin thing with the gears. Mm-hmm. And it said, if you love school, you'll really love work.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I think you and I had the same orientation, kind of coming from, you know, coming from that background of, you know, what it's like to work a rote, you know, thoughtless, basically job over and over again, and knowing,
right, yeah.
Oh yeah, I want to stay away from that.
Right. Yeah, and I wrote the experience up one summer. I needed to have a job, and I worked for a factory on an assembly line. So yeah, that will motivate you to do other things.
Right.
It did me. Being trapped there forever, like the people around me, didn't seem like a reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, and I talked to my kids. You know, my kids have never had to grow up in, you know, the outskirts of Louisville, Kentucky, and, you know, they've been in LA and Austin, and they were in Queensland for a year. So they don't have that kind of, you know, horrible life experience to stay away
right.
from. So it's a little worse.
They take a lot for granted, right?
Yeah. Well, they haven't had like the top of the game, you know, but they've stayed away from the horrible. So that's pretty good.
Right.
But so you start out, you went to University of Iowa, and you came from a traditional speech background, but I wouldn't call you a traditional rhetorician
at all. No, I was really, I think maybe because of the kinds of things I brought to it and the kinds of people I ran into early on, at least one of my, the idea of rhetoric, for instance, that you're resurrecting here a little bit, wasn't part of my background, really. I mean, I think when you do that kind of thing, debate and those sorts of things, you get into sort of the arbitrary nature, and the truth is in there what gets spoken for. So I think it is relevant. So that mindset brings you to it a little bit. But very much at the time, I think at least the teachers I had were trying to expand that into a broader understanding of media influence. And for me, particularly existential kinds of issues, mm-hmm. right? And so my work really took more of that literary focus and philosophical focus in how do we, you know, survive and build ourselves as human beings in the social world. So that really wasn't very popular at the time. And in a way, the whole field kind of moved a different direction. It moved more towards the sociological, more towards studies of power and ideology, mm-hmm. In the cultural studies. So there was a bit of a divergence there. I don't think those things are incompatible to understand things from the point of view of the individual that's dealing with it. But the kinds of analyses and theories that I wanted to pursue lead more in that direction and less in the kind of critical direction of ideology and power.
Yeah, it was interesting coming from University of Texas for my master's degree and that kind of, you know, hyper traditional Hardian kind of count everything and, you know, that sort of speech tradition. And then going down to South Florida, you know, which is, you were essentially the rhetoric department.
Right.
And, you know, Newman was the cultural studies department. Bachman was the guy who had thrown over the entire field of interpersonal
right.
and tried to embrace all the, you know, squishy storytellers. So, you know, getting those two perspectives, just seeing how hard they really diverged, you know, that hardcore speech tradition. And then, like you're talking about, expanding this into critical theory and, you know, existential thought and individual, you know, all that stuff is, they come together really richly, I think.
Right. Well, I think the thing that to me over time brings all of that together is sort of the dynamism of language and kind of the malleability of history. And we're experiencing those things in new and intense ways. Those things come together more for me today than they did back then. That's for sure.
Yeah. You're seeing it play out. Like, I mean, you know, I wandered into, you know, sort of French theory and all the Baudrillard and media simulation and all that stuff kind of through you and kind of through Newman at the same time. And just to see the simulacrum theory just sort of playing out in real time, and you're like, oh my God, that theory actually works. People cannot tell the difference between sort of physical world reality grounding and media world reality grounding. They can't read the difference.
Well, right. In the early 80s, the intellectuals were celebrating postmodernism as this liberatory thing. Well, now you're seeing the other side of that coin, right? The incredulity toward grand narratives. We find ourselves wanting one and wanting enough people to stick to it to make it functional. There is a backside to this, and I think we're seeing it now.
Well, I mentioned this to Newman back when I first started into cultural studies and started seeing all the, you know, history of anthropology and how they would go to faraway places and, you know, hyper describe these people and got more and more mature about how they did it. I'm like, you know, you're just doing consumer research. Like, it's not like the corporations aren't going to see that and use it.
Right.
And that's essentially what the right-wing political machine, all the way from the think tanks down, they've co-opted all that sort of, you know, outside theory and, you know, all that kind of, all the way from the Frankfurt School and everything. They're using it in real time.
Well, and if I recall, I'm willing to be corrected, but it seems to me that I recall the story that ethnography and linguistics and anthropology were all bound up with opening up markets originally in the late 1800s, that this was always a commercially sponsored or a commercially advantageous enterprise, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's always the merchants wanting new markets and the, you know, emperors and things like that funding all these things. And the scientists come along like, oh, we'll do good works while we're there. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know if you did. But I see like this, like, this is part of this project, you know, the idea that you get people using these, I'm not sure they understand it or whatever, but the right wing has a think tank down into communication structures, down into right wing media. It's a very architectured communication flow, and they're flowing out simulacrum narratives, you know, completely just taking the opposite narrative and appropriating it and changing the players. And nobody knows how to counter it on the left. On the liberal side or the democratic side.
Right, I've been thinking a lot about that. And hearing you talk about ethical rhetoric, the challenges, and that's at least as old, I mean, advertising in a way, I think it was Neil Postman that sort of said, well, wait a minute, you know, an ad isn't really true or untrue. You can't just say that's not real or that's not true. What it enacts, right? If it shows you a new car, that's, so we can't argue with it in the same kind of way.
Right.
And Ronald Reagan's media people were very astute on. So this isn't really completely new, but it's gone someplace completely or at least, you know, measurably different.
Yeah.
There's a piece, I think it was in New York Times just in the last couple of days, talking about how the language just in the 6 weeks of Biden, the language has transformed. So they've started tinkering with how things are talked about. And part of that is to use politically correct language, right? And social justice kind of language.
Sure.
To soften some of the harsh rhetoric. The exemplar caught my interest because on the website of Bureau of Land Management, the Biden team has put up a picture of a flowing river and a rural landscape, right? It's a very pastoral, appealing scene. Like this is what's shocking about that is what they replaced, which is a picture of a mountain of coal. Now, what's intriguing is that the Trump people went in there and put a picture of a mountain of coal on the website as the poster of the Bureau of Land Management. What does that say? Both were being very intentional about micromanaging images.
Right.
Both attending to, and even Miller, Trump's speechwriter, is quoted in this article about the importance of these subtle language choices and it's being very, you know, non-biased about his talking about what Biden is doing there. But yeah, this is really important and we did it too. But I get back to that singular, how do images argue? In the case of the flowing river, you might want to be cynical or critical of Biden, say, well, that's a euphemistic kind of, you know, positive reality. And you could undermine that by showing pictures of pollution and neglected places. So right. Say, well, here, there's a cynical reality underneath that. Okay, we all, you know, but there is also sort of like an idealism to it. Okay, this is something we would aspire to. What do you make of a mountain of coal? There's nothing there to be argued with. I guess it sort of says, we're going to be all about, you know, exploiting the natural resources. It's really a destructive image, right? Mm-hmm. It's really here as a counterpoint to the entire purpose of land management and the government's, right? And it is a negative, destructive undermining of the entire politics. Is that unethical?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, like when you're talking about this, it occurs to me that that was the sort of Trumpian approach, at least the large majority of it, was to mine the negative, you know, to find all the dark images and all the horrible victimages and all the everything that could be ugly and nasty, he threw out into his rhetoric. And that's the coal is perfect. That's the dirtiest form of, you know, energy on the planet.
So we have two kinds of untruth here, and a rhetorician can appreciate both. But I guess it was Richard Weaver that sort of says ethical rhetoric shows us better images of ourselves. And the flowing river is an image I want to buy for a positive synergy, if you will. But this other thing is just sort of a unavoidable, destructive. It's an ugly truth. There's a beautiful truth and an ugly truth.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I think that he was an artist of ugliness, you know, and that rhetoric had not really dominated our politics. We're very aspirational, you know, in American politics. Like Reagan was the best example of that ever. You know, he covered up all this social destruction and with aspirational rhetoric, you know, and you see Trump is like, no, I don't need that. My aspirations are just going to be, you know, to be as dark and ugly and make people worried about that as I possibly can. And it's right there in your face.
Right. And it's convenient to talk about Trump as the architect of that, or the Trump, you know, the people who thought this up. But there's a certain number of people really being liberated and buying into that as a kind of a, right, as a mission to throw off this other kind of euphemistic progressive vision.
Yeah, you were talking, you know, before we started about the converting conservatives thing. And that's one of the things I did a little series of many free webinars, like 1 hour webinars, just talking about if you want to actually design out a conversion process for somebody that's been pulled down into that or lives in that, like you have to start with that they are in darkness, you know, and I grew up around darkness. I know what the dark side of the working class looks like. I know what it's like to be trapped into a, you know, at least semi-violent and, you know, uneducated and angry and anxious life. And a lot of people in America, that's their experience of this culture. And so figuring out a rhetoric that speaks to that and then watching people just be drawn to it, you know, you have to start with that. Like, this isn't an aberration. There's a massive part of this culture that feeds on that because that's their life experience.
Right. Well, you began with the observation that the Democrats really haven't quite found a way to speak to that. Have you, right? I mean, I agree completely that you have to start, and that's kind of back to my point of view of where I want to discuss, right? It was in this kind of psychological individual dimension. How is this imagery, how is this language speaking that inner voice to that the person has, right?
Yeah.
You're saying you've got to go into the heart of that darkness.
Right.
And how? I mean, clearly the negative, destructive, defiant rhetoric managed to do that in a way that sort of surprised everybody. And for 4 years, everybody's been kind of trying to shame that or say it's not true or it's not factual. You know, the kinds of standard
Yeah.
Rational techniques of, but once again, it's really easy to undermine the positive vision. How do you undermine something that other than, and I guess the strategy now is to sort of displace it as much as possible and hope that it goes away.
Yeah, that's a horrible strategy though. Like,
it isn't going to go away. It may mutate, but it isn't going to go away.
And that's the thing. These people never go away if you don't help them heal something. I mean, I'm not sure I like the whole therapeutic, you know, language into this that you have to heal them, but it is this idea that admonishing them or telling them that this is wrong doesn't cure them. They just hide it. And then when somebody like Trump comes along and hits that gong, they're like, ah, I'm free. There was a great comic, 90s maybe, was his name, Chris something. And he had a TV show on Fox for a little while. And he's very political. He's kind of out there, but his Fox sitcom started with the premise from his stand-up show, Romeo is Bleeding, that most people in the country are dysfunctional. Most people are unhappy. So we're the normal ones. So quit making TV shows about happy people, you know? And he had a life story where his dad or his mom had shot his dad with a shotgun and had to be, you know, put away and didn't kill him. And he ended up with like 8 wives. And so they just explored this, not from that kind of saccharine sanitized perspective, but like they were in the pain a lot of times. And so when you see that stuff, you're like, oh, well, that makes a lot more sense. If you're going to talk to people in that kind of, you know, dystopian life experience, then you have to get in there with them. You can't admonish it and stand outside of it.
Right. You know? Well, I guess it has to also do with, you know, what are the kinds of choices they have and how do they want to regard those choices? And so part of the appeal of this is that it gives them power and voice that they didn't have in this other vision. And that's, I don't know how you just displace that with some other. I think there has to be some sort of real change in their circumstances.
Yeah. And I like to go into strands. I hate to take on massive armies of rhetoric. I like to take on small, tiny battalions.
Right.
And so like racism, you know, it's one of the key, you know, avenues that everybody's marching down these days, literally. You know, it's so activating that it can get people out of their, you know, homes and protest and that kind of stuff. Well, you know, that's a great place to go in and kind of start to do this kind of work. I talked to a conservative yesterday on the podcast, old Texas family. We talked about how racist our families are, like our grandparents, and our parents aren't so much, but it's that conservative feel just keeps being handed down from generation to generation, and race is the easiest place to locate it. You know, it's just a clear visual, you know, highly distinct cultures, a lot of times separated by economics. And so it's one of those places you really should go in and be able to do rhetorical work with.
Well, I think it's imperative. I mean, the more I observe all of this, I think it comes back to race. And yes, we have our class issues, but we have so thoroughly mapped those onto race mapped race onto the class issues. We can't deal with it straightforwardly as class. And so lurking beneath all of this, it seems to me, is race and our inability to deal with that. So this is the, you know, I, as you were talking, I wasn't sure from whose point of view you sort of said to do that work, from the analyst or the interventionist, but clearly from the point of view of the patient here, right? The person you're trying to reach, in the right. And if you have a working class background too, you heard this growing up all of the time, right there, that race is the explanation and the easiest explanation we have for my circumstances, right? And so those things have been bonded,
right,
in associative ways in all along. How do you start unraveling that? Where do you start pulling? And then I guess the other thing is, you know, religion. I think we're not attending to how much the warrants for all of this get back to being on the right side of God.
Sure.
When we talk about truth and untruth and science and facts and using those as our weapons, you understand the idea of truth held by a big chunk of this population has nothing to do with all of that.
Yeah, no, I grew up hardcore Catholic and evangelical Baptist, you know, so I saw both, you know, two really strong, you know, armies of that stuff. And I understand it really well. I understand what those, what that life experiences is. I understand thinking through mythos. Like I remember as a kid thinking like, you know, you have all these hero characters and supernatural characters and you're asking them for help. I'm like, well, if that's not the Thor and Hulk and the Avengers, then I've never, you know, heard it. But it's this mystical sense that, you know, I grew out of, I moved over into logic and rationality and reason and reading and all these things, but not everybody has. They're still existing in those worlds and it's a story world. And if you want to do any kind of work over there, you better be able to get into their story world, because just telling that's wrong and saying, drag yourself out of it is just, that's ridiculous. That's bad rhetoric. You know?
Right. No, I think so. And once again, the kind of the self-perpetuating journalistic anti-Trumpianism has been how many times, you know, every day we will point out that this is not true. This is a lie. This is not true. This is a lie. And then be shocked that this doesn't change it at all.
Right. It's like, yeah, we got it. It's a lie.
Rather than saying what truth is being spoken are probably more tapped in like on a drum or something. Right.
Yeah.
You know, and we try to come to grips with something like QAnon. How do people believe this? Well, I think you have to fundamentally anthropologically go back and ask what they believe and how they relate to that set of beliefs is a whole different thing than the way you're relating to your, you know, education in science and rationality, the frameworks and what investment they have in these truths. Is a different kind of phenomenon altogether. And furthermore, it's not enough even to sort of say this is, you know, standard mythic stuff. I think we can learn a lot by that framework, but there's something new about the way that they attend to it through contemporary media. So I hear people talking about, you know, the QAnon consumer is a kind of an a la carte consumer. They don't really necessarily buy all of those things. And I'm suspicious that some of these things like all Democrats are pedophiles, maybe is almost a put on to sort of
right.
mess with liberals, right? rather than a held to factual belief. But the other component of approaching that is that to realize that that's a layered and stratified group of people. They don't all relate to it in the same kind of way. If you think about how many people that support Trump, you've probably talked with, who really know that this is, he's shouting untruths, that really don't buy into him, or say they don't, yet somehow they are participating in that drama, the Trumpian drama, as are we.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, I one of the reasons I was really interested in talking to you about this is the Burkean stuff. You know, sure. You drop this stuff right into dramaturgy and you're like, oh, wow, this guy laid out the template for, you know, how you play these games too. And, you know, the QAnon stuff is, I tell people, like, when you just take the media, you know, as your sort of standpoint and realize, like, CSI, the whole CSI thing is, reality isn't real. You have, like, you find all these crazy things underneath it. You know, our media has trained people into these weird conspiracy story structures. It's very easy to move from that over into, oh, QAnon. Like every movie we have, it seems like that's an action movie, is about some hidden evil, you know, that we never get to access until the very end. So we're totally story trained for conspiracy theories like that. It's not weird at all for people to be able to absorb that. But when you look at, you know, the way Burke laid that stuff out, like, oh, well, here's the, if you want to do this, here's the mechanisms that you need to fill in, you know, the characters and the action and the scene and all that stuff, and just fill it in. And turns out it works.
Right. I mean, I think that the, if there's a wellspring to it, is that the drama is constant and it doesn't let up. It isn't that there's coherence between one moment in it and the next, or one rationality, one thematic set of beliefs that comprise an ideology. It's that the drama is always there to be part of every day. And one thing I've noticed about the more conspiratorially minded is even though they're consuming a mass media product, they sort of feel like they individually own it or have, you know, I'm special here. I'm privileged and special because this is my truth, even though I got it from some guy on Fox News. That right. part of it doesn't seem to enter into it. They themselves are special because they're not getting put over on.
Well, that agency, so that kind of story writing, that kind of story constructing, story participating agency, that's social media. And that's that kind of, you know, I can click buttons and move around my stories and my locations. And it's changed the relationship people have to these stories. Like they're not, you know, just receiving them. They're like you said, they're absorbing them and integrating them as, oh, I created this because I chose to watch it. It's a very different, you know, orientation to that construction.
But they're also like soap operas. It's an open text. They're also there every day as a, for whatever the next installment is. And so I think one thing that we have trouble with arguing with conspiracy-minded people is when they may have three or four different conspiracies. I guess I got trained into this arguing about, you know, JFK assassination or whatever. And it would always bother me that if you blow one theory full of hole that Castro didn't do it, then it could be the CIA, and then it moved to O.J. Simpson, right? And like, there's nine different theories, and right. any one of them is okay. So the one thing that it isn't invested in one theory or another theory as a truth is that something must be true other than the thing that everybody else thinks is true. That's the one theme in every one of them.
Right? Yeah, there's so a hidden truth.
If you hold in one of them, they're easily switched to the next one. Well, it could be this, but whatever it is kind of, so it's an open text that gets rewritten over and over again. And the participation in it is really the right. Well, it is the identity given to that.
You know, that's one of the reasons why, like when I come into this stuff and I throw a little bit of rhetoric concepts at people, like the ethical versus unethical split, just to label public discourse in those two terms, nobody does that. And as soon as I do that, they really don't know what to respond. Like, I'm like, my only problem, this is one of the ways I can get conservatives to talk to me easily, is like, I don't care whether you're conservative or not. I don't label myself liberal. I care about how you talk in public. And here are the techniques that are ethical, and here are the techniques that are unethical. And if you talk unethically, I'm never going to vote for you. I'm never going to be pro your candidates. But like, you know, Ted Cruz, if you watched his, you know, speedy oscillation lies, where he went through a, you know, rapid fire, like, oh, I was only going for a day. And they're like, well, you got a ticket coming back for Sunday. He's like, oh shit. You know, and they just went through a series of lies until like he had nothing left. None of his lies worked. Finally tried a little bit of mea culpa and then some photo ops. But I'm like, you know, going from lie to lie to lie is an unethical technique. And if you can get them to at least admit that, you know, they don't go all the way right. down the line to the conclusion of therefore never vote for Ted Cruz, but they have converted a little bit because they don't know how to defend themselves on those on that ground.
Right. And I think once again, we can't just over determine or over simplify the consumer. There's probably a range of feelings about that. How does one, you know, clearly there are some hardcores that, you know, and I've heard them on radio and stuff. Well, Joe Biden's really the totalitarian. You want to talk about yeah. dictator. He's the one, he's going to tell us. Yeah. So there is this kind of reality, to at least many of us, a reality inversion where everything's just been relabeled in an upside down kind of way. But then there's also, you know, kind of the easy relativism. If I were to talk with many of my relatives, well, he's lying. Well, all politicians lie.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. They have
why is this an issue?
Right.
So there's once again some other kind of sideways transcendent truth that is being enacted here that makes that a non-issue.
I call it in my mind like holding them onto a lily pad, one lily pad, until it turns into kind of a skillet. And so like, as soon as, when I talk to the conservatives on the podcast, as soon as they want to jump to a new lily pad, like they say the words Joe Biden, I'm like, no, right. I'm pulling you back over here to Ted Cruz. I said, we're not going to talk about Joe Biden right now until we talk about Ted Cruz. And if I can get them, you know, to reorient in a meta communication sense, it takes away those escape valves and they stop doing it so much, or they stop talking to me until they can adjust.
Yeah. Well, I think so. I think once again, getting them to pinning them down to what is ethical or not ethical that's kind of a vague thing. I think for most people, they don't know what the ethics of that are.
Yeah.
So serial lying and misinformation has got to be high on the list.
Right? You would think.
You
would think that would be enough to disqualify someone. But again, I think the think tank system is genius just because you have smart people figuring how to wiggle out of everything and then handing it down as script. And the wiggles that they've got right now are the one you just said, like, well, you know, yes, he lies, but they all lie. You know, to spread the blame, to spread the villainy and the sin across everybody. And then therefore that's an escape valve. Or they do this thing where Joe Biden does that too. You know, and so it's all that escapism, you know, and that rhetoric. And they've got little paths that have been pre-built for them. I just continually try to cut them off from going down there.
Sure. I suppose there is some, once again, with whataboutism, this sort of belief that both sides participate equally in this kind of propaganda world. And this helps rationalize, you know, why I vote this way rather than that.
Right.
To me, one of the most empty sentences that's repeated over again, well, I agree with Trump's policies. And I always, which ones?
What policies?
Right. And I think that is a kind of a code for, I enjoy being on this side of this particular drama, right? And somehow I'm getting fed here by this constant disruption. How else can one rather choose a mountain of coal over a flowing river? I don't know.
Well, those people, you got to think, you know, with the sort of high rationality, aspirational, the best of us politics rhetoric that America has always kind of adhered to, it leaves behind so many people. You know, you have to be educated. You have to be able to think your way through it. You typically, those are the literate people that resonates with. And there's so little rhetoric going. I used to say that Hillary Clinton, I think, would have beaten Trump if she'd have said two words, if she just said white people at some point, because, you know, the Democrats have moved so hard to sort of multiplicity politics and, you know, minority coalition politics that I think, and I told people this before the election, I'm like, Trump is white, 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 white. And she will never even say it. If she would just say, look, I know there's still a lot of white people in this country and they're worried about all this stuff coming in. There's ways to do America where everybody wins. And she wouldn't do it.
And that was enacted in the campaign itself. I mean, she did not go to those upper Midwest states. And that made the difference in the ballot box. I know the Hillary example is always so, because there's at least 50 things that might have made the difference.
Right.
But I think you're right. I think that's probably one of them is not really speaking to that sense of division that the audience perceived was relevant to their life world, right?
Well, and it's easy. It's one of those things, like when you look at the easy things that are to persuade in your physical life, that's why race, I always point out, race is easy because you can see physical differences in people. I used to say in Los Angeles, like you can't be racist in Los Angeles because you'd be exhausted. You don't know what anybody is. You know, it's like Barbados. Am I supposed to hate you? I don't know. What is that? But race is easy to locate. And, you know, when you have stuff like that, that's a dominant rhetoric. If you don't talk about it, and like encroachment, I see this a lot because I've moved around in so many different sort of high, you know, urban cities. White culture, traditional white American culture, like the guys I went to college with from Coldwater, Ohio, you know, who had maybe, you know, three black families in the whole community. Suddenly, like I remember when Louisville, where I was growing up, because it was a high Catholic community, started bringing in refugees from Asian countries. And suddenly there was an Asian community in the middle of this incredibly, you know, German white Catholic city.
Right.
And there was no training for it. There was no, you know, there was no cultural studies of, hey, what's this mean and how do you interact? And it just got more and more irritating to the people that have been there. And if you don't deal with that reality of America is an encroaching culture, you know, and people are physically experiencing that, and you need to give them a way to deal. Then you got guys like Trump come up who were like, yeah, I'll give you a way to deal with it. Build a, you know, fucking wall around them and keep them out of the country.
Right. Well, and it's, once again, it's back to, if you look through that, that Rust Belt, where for whatever set of structural, technological, you know, changes, these really were kind of stagnant cultures. But the meatpacking industry bringing in people from Africa and for those kinds of jobs, and the person driving his truck down to the whatever, it's easy to say to himself, okay, you know, we're giving away our jobs to immigrants, right?
Yeah.
Even, notwithstanding the irony that that's not a job they would do, which is the reason for that.
Right.
And once again, that it's the easy difference and the easy attribution to make.
Yeah, and that's the easy, you know, as well as I do, the easy always, almost always wins. You know, nobody has a lot of spare time to think about these issues. They're not getting educated. This stuff gets very complicated and tangled almost instantly. And you and I are both, you know, trained in rhetoric, and we kind of look at it and go, I got to think about this a little bit, you know, sometimes to figure something out. So they don't even have that kind of infrastructure, and you're asking them to make fairly complicated political decisions. But then, you know, somebody with a big axe like Trump comes through and just cuts through all of it. And you're like, well, that's better, you know?
Right. Well, you know, I mean, that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is half the people in those states didn't think that. Half of those people in those states did see their way through it. So one has to ask why they grabbed for this particular group of people grabbed for that account rather than some other, when, you know, not everybody thought that way.
Right.
And their choice is getting made here one way or another. And this is an appealing decision. Why? I mean, you know, when we're talking about race, this isn't just start. I mean, we've not been able to speak about sort of the white nationalist movement as a factor in the last 4 years. But before that, you know, the 8 years before that with Obama, there was so much subterranean kind of racial, you know, conflict being that there's sort of a lid on all of this that was part of the frustration. I mean, so there seems to be kind of a reaction back against that. And now we have real conflict. So once again, what this rhetoric has done, and everybody has said as much, you got two teams here, and which team do you want to be on? And that sort of makes the rest of these issues go away.
Yeah, I don't know. I maybe because I move across those worlds so much, you know, and even in sort of higher level academics, I was always drifting in and out of the aesthetics of, you know, high culture versus like, what are you people, you know, like, why can't I say fuck more here, you know, at this class? And comedy, you know, when you go into comedy and you start to see, like, I used to do this thing in my stand-up show about, I would ask people who in here believes in creationism, you know, who's more Bible oriented, and, you know, 70-80% of the audience in the clubs I was working. And I would do this thing about, it was basically, you know, built around wombats. I'm like, I'll show you, you explain wombats to me, because wombats have square poop. They're the only animal right on the planet that has square poop. So you tell me why an omniscient being, you know, would choose to make an animal with square poop. Give me an explanation. And they always got to, well, it's funny. I'm like, okay, I'm cool with that. You know, God is, he's trying to make the angels laugh, right? And then I would say, okay, well, who believes in evolution? And they'd all, you know, 20% or whatever. And I'd be like, well, you tell me, what evolutionary advantage did that animal have with square poop? Because it has to be something. There's no round poop wombats left. And so comedy got me to both sides, you know, where I could criticize them, you know, for the flaws in their logic strands underneath what they're doing. And at least gets them at least somewhat trained to be criticized. You know, it gives you a little bit of space to do that. Whereas like right now with the two camps thing, if you don't have an avenue in there that makes them think you're safe enough to listen to, then you got no chance at all.
Well, I think, and you and I have probably spent a long time talking about this, that comedy is a way of doing that, right? That you can, without threatening, you can agitate the peripheries of that kind of consciousness, right? That is a way in, mm-hmm. to pose these kinds of contradictions whether it is ultimately transformative or not is a tougher question. Right?
It's a, you know, when I talk about converting conservatives, people are like, well, have you been successful? I'm like, well, what do you define as success? Because if I move somebody a quarter of a percent, then I think that's a success. You know, I can't get anybody to ditch their evangelical, you know, hardcore religion in an hour on a podcast, but I can move them around a little bit.
Sure. And as with all, you know, but something fundamental has to change, I think, in the language that they have to deal with their circumstances. And once again, comedy is a great way to open that up or to produce indeterminacy. Your language is not quite covering all the bases here, right? Your belief here about, creation doesn't quite cover the wombat. So that's a non-threatening way in to just introducing uncertainty about it.
Well, that's a really interesting point too, that indeterminacy and uncertainty, allowing that into your life, because that is part of the problem with the right. They find that incredibly disruptive and anxiety producing, and ergo they want really strong answers. And I run into this a lot with doing that kind of work, to get them to be okay with indeterminacy, even of language. That's a great win for, you know, talking to that orientation.
Well, sure. I mean, that's one of the battle lines, is because the easy solutions, the final solutions, are all tragic. And they're all sacrificial. So getting people to live with, you know, and I think probably you could chart this with the economy or something. People are much greater at living with difference. And diversity and uncertainty, as long as, you know, they're getting nourished in some, you know. But then when there's conflict, when people get laid off, then they start looking around for who's to blame here.
Yeah. When the money goes away.
Finding out what is the sense of loss that this group of people has, and how is this explaining this to themselves? Is to me the analysis of the ideology, right?
So do you talk?
Zine, it's another question.
Do you have family members that you like? You cross the lines with? Do you do any kind of rhetoric work on people, or are you just kind of like, you know, I'm just going to lay back and not really get involved in all this?
Yes, I do have family members that are difficult, I don't think I can win. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of it is just let it pass.
Right.
Right. Because once again, in this particular case, and I think this is probably generalizable to a good portion of it, they're looking for the fight.
Yeah, right? They need enemies.
They're wanting to sharpen their tools on me. I rope-a-dope, I hang back and wait for the good shot.
But, right.
A lot of times,
and I'm cheating. Like, I've turned this into like somewhat of a business and somewhat of a brand and a mission, you know, in life. And so I'm running the podcast, you know, so I have basically the communication power, and I invite them, and I know how to, you know, make sure they feel safe and don't feel attacked. So it's different. Like, if I had to, you know, engage people with the same level of power, you know, just in everyday life in a family conversation, then it would be very different. You know, trying to do that kind of work.
Sure. But what you're doing is essentially dialogic as well, right? It's invitational. And once again, back to the kinds of things that we can think of to get past this particular moment, that seems to be high on everybody's list. Meanwhile, politics and division grind themselves out. You know, we can talk about bipartisanship. We can talk, but, you know, tomorrow we're going to vote. And those investments are still the same. So, you know, but I think as rhetoricians, what can you do except sort of budge the language off of this? Like you say, if I can move them a quarter of a percent, at least it's moved.
Yeah. You know, I took a class at UT or I sat in a class once from Carl Weiss, the sociologist at UT in the business school. And I remember he had a famous article called about small wins, that if you look at all the great football teams in the history of the NFL, like the Steelers had won like six Super Bowls, and their record against teams with 500 and above records was 500. They won half the time. And then their records against teams that were below 500 were 98-2, you know, so they won all the small things, all the easy victories, and everything else, you know, it's 50-50. And so, but if you have that orientation where you just build up enough easy victories, all of a sudden you look like the greatest all-time champ of the world. And just not triggering the right, you know, is a victory, because, you know, both sides. And my daughter, you know, is a hyper millennial. She's 21. She's got all the, you know, she does professional makeup. So she's worked in the drag queen community for a long time doing professional makeup, and, you know, very, very sensitized to any kind of trans issue or, you know, any of that kind of stuff. And the language challenges from, you know, 57-year-old me trying to talk down into that community, the intricate, you know, ness of that language, as you well know, it's like, how do you can't not make mistakes.
Right.
And so you end up with these theories of just, you know, reducing your communication to almost nothing, which isn't going to be, you know, valuable to anybody. So I've had to help her sort of move over into a meta level of like, well, you need, if you want people to talk differently, you need to get them over there. You know, you
can't. Well, and that's where that shoe fits on the progressive foot too, right? Policing language and being the truth that condemns.
Yeah, and they're so hyperactivated.
On the other side of that. That's part of the barrier to dialogue here, absolutely.
Yeah, so even if you're well intended, that triggerable psyche, you know, that is so raw, and it's all over the right, and it's definitely all over the far left, and like, okay, so what we need is some sophistication and non-triggering, you know?
Right. Well, both sides have an investment in the conflict, right? I mean, that the conflict is the drama that they're living for, and how they can best be themselves. And so in the case of, you know, if you've been on a college campus the last 10, 12 years, that the political correctness thing that is so much, many comedians also suffering it, that's a source of power to people who otherwise have none. is to use that ideological tool to judge others. And that becomes sort of the flex of the critical muscle. Is to posit that, you know, that this is the way we all ought to be. And this is how we're, once again, like Biden's transformation of all the language, changing all the language is the rhetorical strategy.
Yeah, right? It's hard to do it. It's just hard to watch it. Like, I make the point to my daughter, and again, this is part of the power structure, I think, that you get when you have, you know, some type of credibility as an academic, at least what people see from the outside, is that you can always retreat into the meta, you know, as I'm just trying to instruct you. And I tell her, like, it's an organic language. Language is organic. You can't force artificial things into an organic language. Language chooses because of, you know, thousands and thousands of people using it and going, oh, this is kind of fun to use. You know, forcing me into an awkward pronoun is a much more difficult task, and you can do it, but you're going to get a lot of blowback. You're going to have a lot of failure. You're going to have a lot of, you know, side loss in there as you try it. And so if you want to do that, you need to get really good at it, I think. And I can help you learn how to do that.
Well, I think there's also a flawed language theory, a flawed theory of persuasion operating there, is that if you just relabel the reality, that it will change. I think to some extent that has to happen. And maybe it's another example of small victories adding up. But what we also know is that if you don't change those fundamental attitudes that are being invested there, they will simply make the new terms derogatory.
Right.
We have a way of making the language serve our purposes. So, you know, what really, you know, push comes to shove is, I think, on the other side of when do really hardcore conservatives, you know, people who are anti-gay, anti-trans, whatever, when do they fundamentally change? It's when their son or daughter
right.
makes this a family issue, and they can, you know, that contradiction that between those attitudes and their happiness forces that issue, right? So back to conversion, what does it really take?
Right.
As long as you're just, you know, or you can have the kind of, once again, the people who are not invested are this group in the middle that for which that particular kind of agenda just fuels their, that's how you can replace a beautiful river with a lump of coal. And that somehow means something. That living in defiance of that. I remember last time I was through Kansas, I stopped into this small town hardware store with a little old lady behind the counter. And on the way out, I wished her a happy holidays. And she says, "We say Merry Christmas here."
Aggressive Merry Christmas.
Yeah. She, I mean, and in a nice kind of accepting way. I didn't feel condemned. I felt tutored, you know. But she made her point, and she was very astute in being a critical, observer of who I was and what I was saying.
That's interesting. I, you know, when you're talking about that, we start down that the issue of triggering, you know, when language becomes, you know, hyper triggerable, like the triggers become so easy to do, and all these landmines that you've got laying around linguistically. And but there's also that big swath in the middle that's non-triggerable by almost everything, you know, that sort of traditional American political apathy where it's like, Trump versus Biden, nothing's going to change. And I think that got shrunk, you know, with the Trump, you know, phenomenon, like people are now seeing clear distinctions in some ways. But I think when Biden comes in, like they're starting to expand it again, you know, that kind of, they all lie. And that's how I noticed, like towards the end of Trump, I started seeing this come up into the right wing community of, he lies, you know, he's got a bad personality, and they could actually admit that finally, but it doesn't matter because they all lie and they all have bad personalities.
Or there's something unspoken that the other side is worse about something, right?
They'll balance it one way or another, but it's that non-triggerableness of, you know, getting people to fear Trump, for example, like this whole resurrection of the fascist, you know, imagery and terminology and all this stuff. And most Americans don't even know what a fascist is. They don't know that there was a fascism in Italy before Germany. They don't know any of that stuff.
Right. Or certainly the way the term is applied, just like socialist or any of these others, is so unhelpful, right?
Well, I think there's
a stereotype or dismiss rather than.
There's a play in here because I'm writing on this stuff as I go, which has been kind of fun, like not having to write it in a super academic sense, but more as in like a instruction to regular people sense. But laying out the unethical persuader's playbook, like if you want to cheat, I'm going to show you how to do it. And then the counter book, like I'll show you how to counter all these things. And so like right now we're struggling because we don't have a language to talk about this politics. This is new. Like I think social media and cable media and the simulacrum and all that has created a new type of communication for the politics. It's carrying a lot of the same old stories, but it in a very new way. Like distribution has become instant. Production has become indistinguishable between professional production and regular production. And so we're pulling all these old terms like sociologists, and you see communists start coming up again. And fascists, and I'm like, those have been dead terms for a long time, and we're not having anything new to replace them. So I think there's a play about a new political lexicon.
Well, I've often thought of these terms as kind of hermit crabs that we'll move into these old shells and animate them again, right?
Yeah,
it's not the same, right? Charting it, I think, is the critical enterprise. And you mentioned Burke. I think that is among most things, his analysis was looking at the historical transformations of these particular kinds of terms.
Right.
So I think, you know, contemporarily, ahistoricism is a problem, not recognizing that these things happened before. For instance, I was reading just this morning, I think, about how there were all kinds of mob rebellions in the late 1800s.
Yeah, I saw
that post-Civil War. we had an attempt to at equality. We had an attempt. Black people did vote, and they did occupy local offices until white mobs stamped that out. And, right. and once again, if you look at this kind of good old days that we're hearkening back to with the Confederate flag and the statues of Robert E. Lee, that's around 1910. That's not really the Civil War, and that's a mythic Civil War that people were remembering and using for ideological purposes, responding to very immediate things in their environment. So the old South really is, you know, we're not really trying to arc back to what was going on in 1855. We're trying to arc back to Reconstruction literally got made there.
Once again,
the progressive movement has been beating its head against that wall all of this time,
right.
and making progress. I think that's the other thing, is that in the culture war, I mean, part of this is that in the culture war, the liberal agenda has won most of it in the last 50 years. Change has dramatically happened. And the conservatism is a lament for the past. It is
exactly
trying to resist that.
Yeah. I start the little seminar on converting conservatives. My program is convert one conservative. I'm like, it's too much work to convert a lot of them. So just pick one.
One conservative at a time.
What if every liberal would just pick one conservative and make them their project? And if you had 10% success, there's another 7.5 million votes. Great. We win. It's no problem. So, but I start that by talking about, you know, just use some of the binaries that help you understand these cultural forces a little more easily. And one is old versus new, right? Like conservatives like the old, they like old myths. They like the old ideas, and it doesn't matter about truth.
Or the myth of whatever that was.
Yeah. And like, I remember reading how, I guess it was Wilson. Was it Woodrow Wilson? Or is a president who basically reconfigured the South, changed the story, wrote a book about it. This whole genteel South and the death of the genteel South. And that was never part of the narrative until like the 20s, you know.
Right, the Southern agrarians really, you know, from the 20s on to the mid 50s, were that was their project, the sort of eulogizing this old South as this social ideal, the proper balance between the individual and the community.
Well, and it does go back to the, you know, nature versus this kind of city, you know, world. And, you know, my thesis was about, you know, on family farm, like how they destroyed the family farm by using, you know, tech farms to take them out. And they had to go back into the story, you know, of families, small families bringing their kids up and the tragedy, and try to use enough of that tragedy to trigger America to go back in and protect that world. And it's the same thing. It's that
just at the time when corporations were taking over agriculture, right?
Yeah. And that's one of the ways they did, is they went in. And but you saw like in movies like The River and Country and some of these, you know, movies that came up that showed, you know, horrible corporation driving out the small farmer, and you had Farm Aid and all that at the time. But, you know, that turns out the corporation can just also, you know, appropriate that entire mythology and just throw it over top of its tractors, and they were just fine. You know, but that lament for the agrarian, I think, is really still super strong in this country. It just gets recycled over and over again.
Sure. I don't know why exactly, except that you've seen the recent sort of attempt to bridge difference ad with Bruce Springsteen in a chapel in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That this is the middle. This is right. This is physically, but also ideologically, the sacred space of this, you know, agrarian past is the meeting ground here that we're going to. Well, you commented on something I wanted to because I thought it was very important, is that you sort of said that, you know, there is this not an absence of this non-trigger space, and I think, you know, we don't take stock of how much society works by not being political. People not participating and letting elites do it and feeling comfortable about it. And it's only when push comes to shove economically that people tend to want to risk whatever it is to change things, because there will be loss associated here with conflict. And, you know, to jump from the voting, the number of people that voted in Trump versus Clinton which was like almost a historic low, right? Or at least a moderate reason to, right, all of a sudden, each side getting at least 10 million more votes. You know, something that's happened, and I don't see it, it didn't just happen in those 4 years, Trumpism was part of it, but politicizing everything. And I think once again, for a lot of people in the working class, there is a new kind of literacy, however flawed, mm-hmm. and there is a new kind of recognition that these images, this language, these things matter and need to be, right? So I need to be corrected by this old lady about how I say Merry Christmas. That's the tip of some other ideological iceberg and training going on there. You know, the ugly side of that is people like me destroying Christmas because I'm, you know, whatever, a liberal. But we're going to defend it here in Kansas, right?
Right. So, I'm making my stand here at the hardware.
But the hyper politicization of everything, and that is an effort on the part of the right to bring people to attend to that in a certain kind of way. I think that the difference is, we ask, why don't Democrats fight that? Is that we fundamentally don't want that conflict, or many of us, right? I think once again, the ultra progressives maybe are invested in the battle, but I think most people just kind of want that to go away. So we can go, you know, having won and feeling good about liberal society and justice being done and my 401k getting fat, we don't really want the conflict. So,
I sometimes describe it to people. I laid out all the different things that Trump does as a politician than what regular politicians do. And I described it as he broke open the political pinata, but he had like 10 different sticks to do it with. And as soon as that broke open, people were like, oh my God, politics is in everything. You know, it's like a replay of the Churchill speech. We will do politics in the beaches. We will do politics. And, you know, you are not getting away from this anymore. And I remember Dino Katanda. And I think
that must be the sense in which he's a hero, is that he's, right, he's whacking at it with a stick every day. I had a similar kind of, conversation, I guess, about the impeachment. I'm clearly, you know, the Democrats last attempt here to bring. And I thought, you know, the man rules by shitstorm. This is just another shitstorm.
Yeah.
He's not going to really lose here, regardless of the vote. I mean, also in terms of as much as we want to forecast, he kept the storm alive.
If you counted how many shitstorms, everything from shit drizzles to, you know, insurrections, like it, right. I don't know if you could even count it. Like every day he would have 2, 3, 4, 5 different things that he would, you know, blast into the world. I remember just how quiet it got the day when Twitter cut him off. There was like a silence that moved out over the entire nation. And it's basically been here ever since. You see little flame ups of Marjorie Taylor Greene and things like that. But just to escape, you know, it's like getting out of the psych ward where you've had a schizophrenic in the room with you, and you walk out and you're like, what is that? It's nothing. You know, and Americans, that sense of politics following them, you know, to every single place, every part of their day, every conversation, never been around before. It's hard.
Right. And that was one of the early observations that people made about, you know, communities where a lot of Fox News was being observed. This was going on from dawn to you know, midnight. The channel never changed.
Right.
It was a constant, right, feeding. So why is that person's world being, you know, finding no respite anywhere else, no non-political space to occupy in the culture? So you know, once again, it is the culture war. And
yeah, it's fascinating to watch what happens. You know, America, like, we've never liked politics. Everybody has always ignored it. I mean, the State of the Union speech every year would get like just irritation, you know, because it was, you know, on TV. And suddenly, you know, to be able to use reality show politics to just make this, you know, flame up to something where I've got to pay attention to it because it may come and kill me. you know, whatever he's doing may reach me today. And, you know, I think a lot of people who have come to America, I've talked to different Black friends who've talked about, yeah, you know what? That's how I've lived my whole life in America, is always worried. Cause I remember I was dating a woman at the time when I guess it was right before the election or during the election. And we watched the election returns together, and she was she's getting very nervous, even though like we were winning. And I'm like, what's the matter? She's like, I'm afraid of what the rednecks are going to do here to a Black woman over the next week. And I'm like, it never even occurred to me that the retribution would come at me. And so, you know, that kind of the white middle class now experiencing the actual violence of, you know, living in a contentious America, very different.
Right. And it is unsettling. I think that it will, once again, that desire to return to kind of a non-political way of being will get tested here. One of the commentators that I've been enjoying all across these months is Steve Schmidt, the guy who ran the campaign with Sarah Palin and the senator, right, from Arizona, McCain. Mm-hmm. And he has now become, he's part of the Lincoln Project and become, a Democrat. And he's saying, you know, the coalition that Biden has performed, if you let up, we will never win another election. Because if they ever get power again, they're going to change all of these rules. Furthermore, we're seeing a lot of that played out in these state legislatures.
Yeah, right? Instantly.
That the game board may be radically different next time around. And our desire is to go, wow, we won. We can return to normal. And we don't have to attend to this anymore and get back to the other stuff I was doing. And that might be nice, but it's not clear to me that that can be the case.
Well, you start to do this hero villain, you know, if you're the intensity of your villain has to be strong enough to activate your actual behavior, right? Mm-hmm. And I watched Stacey Abrams, you know, what she did in Georgia was basically use Trump, you know, or the Senate, you know, the red Senate. If you let them get in there, then we'll never get anything done. And that villain was strong enough. Like that's become the new, I would call super villain, you know, for the left in politics is the red Senate, and everybody's blaming, you know, the Senate and what it does to filibuster and block progressive policies and all this. But I think the state legislatures are also one of the things that you can raise up as the left, as a supervillain to really fear, to really get people to do stuff about it. And I think you saw it in Georgia, you know, that kind of, we have to get, you have to register everybody. You have to get everybody to the polls. You have to actually do, you know, the boots on the ground of politics if you're going to win.
Right. Well, once again, there was still the frame of the Senate and the national election and the controversy that surrounded that. When everybody starts looking the other direction, and they pass laws about who gets to report the electoral votes, and, you know, I'm assuming some people are going to remain vigilant, but
I don't know, man. The right is very good about, like, and again, that's the unethical playbook. Like, there are no moral strictures. There's no thing, no technique you don't use. The right is fully on board with that. That's why the insurrection and actually going to violence in politics is not at all a stretch. It's the natural culmination of every type of will to power. You saw it in Germany, you saw it in everything else, because you'll win, you'll lose, you win, you lose, you win, you lose. And then, you know, everybody starts figuring out your techniques. Turns out, you know, murder hasn't been used yet, and they'll eventually get there. I mean, they used rubber bullets and things like that in their Antifa, you know, wars, so they didn't have the bodies on the ground. But that's really the only difference I could see, is no bodies on the ground.
Well, it once again, how to rhetorically move us past this point, right? I mean, isn't that the mission, right?
Sure.
Is to avoid bodies on the ground, to somehow elevate this in such a way that some kind of transcendent space gets created.
Yes. The rhetoricians are going to save us.
But I'm not sure, and so good work. I'm not sure it will return to being non-political, right?
No, I don't think that's an option anymore. Yeah.
Or sometimes I think it's just I'm aging, right? And this is what older people do. Right?
Well,
so, yeah, I moved a long way from being concerned about existential crises and transformations to the same thing we've been talking about. Right?
Yeah, we've been talking about this stuff for, you know, I was 22 when I arrived in Texas, or 21 when I arrived in Texas. So this has been circulating around my life for almost 40 years. And it's, you know, it's one of those things I've always been tantalized by, that I know that they're really super smart people who can think their way through this. It's just not what we typically do. Like we, you know, we think about it, but we hold it in academic, you know, circles and courses, and we do a good job as we can with that stuff. But it's figuring out that true communication bridge between, like, you know, good meaning liberals who need better tools to fight a new phenomenon. It's interesting to me. I don't know if I can turn it into a full business or what, but I'm going to work into it enough where I can bring guys like you on and, you know, let people in theory hear your thoughts.
Well, and I think bringing on the comedians who are sort of, you know, language technicians and a poetics that maybe is trying to find exactly that.
Yeah.
That way in.
Yeah. The cool thing about comedians, they don't think all the way through the issue, but they find the juicy little morsels. And you're like, oh, that's awesome. There's a guy, the first guy I did a podcast with, Ted Simmons, who he has 15 minutes on the Fed, you know, and he can make it funny and can actually explain to people who've never even probably even heard the term a little bit about what the Fed is and its history. And it becomes a conspiracy theory, you know, but it's a really nice little creative piece that he can, you know, take out and actually does in real comedy clubs in Alabama.
Right. Plus it's going to load those things with preservatives so that they can survive this, you know, oral/media culture, that there is kind of an expiration date on all these historical events. And if you can attach it to, right, a memorable, sometimes humorous event, it gets passed around.
Yeah, I think that's the real promise of entertainment. And again, it's something that has always kind of tantalized me, that academics doesn't add enough entertainment into it in order to carry it as a vehicle to real people, you know? Like,
well, that's been a problem. I mean, as you know from our previous discussions and your own work, comedy was not looked at, and leisure time was not looked at. History was a history of wars and tragic events.
Yeah.
Because that's where you can point to is when that happened.
Yeah, that's important. That's serious. Yeah.
Work is where the work gets done and play doesn't matter. But those lines have been blurred so thoroughly, where so much of this ideological work is in our entertainment. And once again, nobody has been more astute at bringing that to the forefront than the right critics. Sort of in everybody's face with that all of the time. So,
yeah.
Which has bred another kind of cynicism and dismissal, which needs to be somehow bridged by other approaches.
Well, this has been super fun, man. I'm going to circle back around and drag you into this a lot because I like talking to you. So I want to do this again sometime.
Well, I like being in touch, and I appreciate your asking me to do this.
Yeah, I like I said, I want to expose people to rhetoricians, and especially the ones that I think have a good feel for, like, your stuff. I think, you know, we didn't talk about a lot of your academic work, really, about bringing it into the therapeutic, into the personal, into the way that people, you know, incorporate this stuff into their lives. I think is super fascinating and would be very useful. So I'll circle back around and see if we can talk about that at some point.
All right, Dan. Well, once again, thanks a lot.
All right.
We'll see you soon. Yeah.
Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We will see you again next time. Get out there and learn some rhetoric and clean up the world.